The Future Proof Podcast from News Talk.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland. Hashtag believe in science.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof the Podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. Thank you for subscribing, downloading, rating, and all that nonsense that we do day to day. I'm losing my mind here slowly. I won't lie to you. Coming up on this week's podcast, we're going to be asking the question, could you repopulate the world with just two people? Adam and Eve have done it, so clearly it can be done. The question is, could we do it again? We'll be talking about species and what species need to thrive and what the problem is. And there's one or two you can probably think of. Before we get into that, though, if you'd like to comment on the program, you can email us, science@newstalk.com. You can also find us on Twitter. We're at Newstalk Science, and we get to all of your comments at the end of this podcast. Obviously, we get to last week's comments in this week's podcast. Otherwise, that would be very impressive. I don't think we have gotten it. Even though News Talk has been bought by Bauer, we don't yet have the technology to travel through time. So, first things first, it's time to look back at the week's science news. And joining us via Skype are Dr. Susan Kelleher from DCU and from UCD, Dr. Shane Bergen. You're both very welcome. Our first story. Islands in the stream, that is what we are. It's another climate change story for you, Shane, and this is to do with a current.
Yeah, current affairs, as it was, Jonathan. This is. I shouldn't laugh. Because
no, I'm glad
this
you laughed yourself, because at least somebody laughed at it.
So an international collaboration of scientists, including some from Maynooth University, have published work this week in Nature Geoscience. And they've shown rather worryingly that the circulation system in the North Atlantic that gives rise to the Gulf Stream is weakening, and it is at its weakest point for over a millennium, which is very concerning. As listeners will know, the Gulf Stream carries warm water towards Ireland and toward Europe, and that gives us our very temperate climate. If you were to travel due west, you get to the middle of Canada, where it's far, far colder than it is here. So anything that would threaten it is worrying. And they've seen that from looking at ice core measurements, that it really is at a very unstable state. And it hasn't been this unstable for over a millennium. And they said what will happen as a result of this, perhaps it's happening already, is that we'll have an increased incidence of stronger winter storms, and we'll have more heat waves in the summer. And that both of those are not good. They said this is likely to get worse in the next 20 to 30 years, and it is a result of global warming. However, they said we haven't passed a tipping point, but that could come sometime this century. And so we're not
talking about a runaway situation where we can't get back to where we were.
Exactly. So you have this huge circulatory system of warm water coming up from the Caribbean toward us, and it meets then colder climates, and it sinks and it goes back down. And because of global warming, we're affecting things like the salinity of the ocean, and that's interfering with this cycle. But we haven't reached the point of no return. However, we're getting there. And this is the analogy here would be like trying to stop a train that's moving very, very fast, or a big boat. It takes a lot of effort to slow it and turn it in the direction you want to get to. And they say the consequences of this thing switching off are so drastic that even increasing the risk of it happening from 1% to 10% is not something that we should allow. And so the scientists are saying, look, this is another canary in the mine here, that if we must change the way we live.
Yeah, we've been saying that for 10 years. I mean, whatever about reducing the plastic that we put in our waste bins, or you know, turning off the lights, sort of halting the changing currents of the ocean seems like something that requires a more global approach. Susan, our second story has to do with chemicals. As a chemist, I thought you'd like this one.
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Jonathan. That is very appropriate. I misstate the last day. In recent years, it has become apparent that there are certain chemicals in plastics which can be harmful to our health. And so people have begun to buy PBA-free or phthalate-free products, as we know. But the problem is, however, that the list of harmful chemicals in plastics is actually rather long. And there has been no systematic study carried out to understand exactly which chemicals are the most harmful and how frequently we are exposed to them. So this study by researchers in the University of Michigan and the Technical University of Denmark does just that. The work supported by the UN Environmental Programme categorises over 400 chemicals in plastic toys and then ranks them from most to least dangerous or most to least toxic. And the focus on plastic toys is important as it's one of the main sources of plastic in homes. Believe it or not, they did a study as part of this work and they found out that the average weight of plastic toys being purchased per year per child in Western countries was 18.3 kilograms.
What?
I know. Could not. I'm looking around thinking, yep, that's plastic. Yep, that's plastic. So obviously, first of all, the sheer amount of it. And second of all, the fact that children do tend to put things in their mouths, like these plastic, you know, toys in their mouths. This is obviously an increased route of exposure. So we have to be careful around that. So the toys are categorized into hard plastics, soft plastics and foam plastics. And then 126 substances were identified as harmful to children's health.
Okay, cut to the chase, Susan. How bad are these things?
Yeah, overall plastics, you know, softer plastics are the worst. And you also, interestingly, children breathe in a lot of the dangerous chemicals. So you want to make sure that you're reducing the volume of the material in your house or ventilating. And also there are other, you know, proven effects of reducing the amount of toys that children have. So reduce the amount of these plastic items in your home. And if they are there, just ventilate the room really well so that children aren't being exposed.
Like, are you saying these plastics are quite volatile and that they're giving off molecules? Like what? I mean, obviously, we can't name brand names, but you're talking about like the normal sort of plastic figurines or playpenny type stuff that you'd find.
Yeah, absolutely. And the small volatile molecules are found, they're not bound physically to the backbone of the polymer. They're just swashed in there. And when the polymer heats up or if it breaks down as it's been chewed on, they're released. They're very common. I mean, they're common across every brand. I suppose what people are looking for is two things. First of all, regulation of the use of them. So the most toxic ones, this paper shows, you know, is able to categorize which of them are the most toxic and should be avoided. And then alternatives that are generally plant-based and from plant-based oils. So that's going to be better and a better option for manufacturers in time.
Another thing to worry about. Let's move on to slightly happier news, Shane. Our third story is some hope surrounding a universal coronavirus vaccine.
Yeah, absolutely. This is the cure for the common colds, if we get this right, which is incredible. It's the holy grail in immunology, really. And it comes off the back of an editorial in Science magazine this week from two bigwigs in the vaccine world, where they've said, we now have the capacity to think about a universal coronavirus vaccine, but we have to start now, that this is going to require global effort and it's going to cost a fortune. But to put that in context, COVID-19 has cost somewhere between $8 and $16 trillion so far. And what they're saying is that 1/500th of that as an investment on a global scale across governments, academia, industry, NGOs, etc., could find a vaccine for all coronaviruses, which include the common cold.
This is, of course, extremely important because we're seeing these new variants. And if these variants start to take hold and mutations become popular, countries aren't able to clamp down on the coronavirus, it mixes in people. We could possibly be in a rolling situation where even vaccination doesn't work and we are essentially facing coronavirus from day one, year after year.
So we have vaccines, miraculously almost, for SARS-CoV-2, the virus that causes COVID-19. And many of them are standing up to variants of that particular a virus. But what about other ones? What about, like, you know, so we had SARS-CoV-1 back in 2002. Now we have COVID-2. There's no reason why there wouldn't be another jump from an animal species to humans in a few years, they make the point that the way we're living now in this sort of, there's so many people and the way we farm and the way we handle animals, that this is going to become more likely. And in a way, whilst it has been awful, the fatality rate of COVID-19 hasn't been anything like some of the previous coronaviruses. So MERS in 2012, that's the Middle East Respiratory Syndrome, that was 34% fatal. So if we got something as fatal as that, imagine the damage it would cause to us all.
I'm going to stop you for two reasons. One, because I do think this is well-trodden territory. And two, this is supposed to be the happy story where we talked about, you know, global collaboration. So
it is, right?
Because the happy part?
No, the happy part is we now have the capacity to do this. It's not a case that the science isn't able. What science has, biomedical, computing and engineering capability, it isn't a linear path from here to the end goal, but we have the capacity. And what they're saying is we need a global effort and we need lots and lots of investment in basic scientific research. This is really important, even for countries like Ireland. SFI is about to launch its strategy next week. I think I would be looking at that very closely.
Susan, our final story is to do with the return of the dodo, so to speak.
But yeah, not quite, but yes, Shane, you and perhaps yourself as well, Dante, like, you know, you really enjoyed the Garden Bird Survey the last few months. Am I right?
Yes.
Could you imagine how incredible it would be to spot a bird that hasn't been seen for 180 years? Well, this is what happened to Mohamed Saranto and Mohamed Rizki Fazan, who were two Borneo locals that were walking in a forest on the island. They spotted a bird that they didn't recognize and managed to catch it. They took photos of it and let it go and got in touch with the local bird watching societies. It turns out that it was a bird called the black-browed babbler that was thought to be extinct, and the last sighting had been in the 1840s. There's only one known specimen in the world of this, and it's on display in the Netherlands National Museum of Natural History. And really interestingly, they're after learning a whole lot of new things about this bird species, because during the taxidermy process of making this one species we have, it changes the colour of the bird's legs and beaks and eyes. So these photos are a real clue to how this bird really looks, and for the first time in 180 years, being able to see it in real life. So it's amazing. It's a really nice story.
How'd you just come across a bird and catch it? I mean, that's not a skill I have. I mean, maybe it's a thing in Borneo, but like, how do you go, oh, that's an interesting bird, I'll just reach out and grab it? Like, how did they have a net with them? Were they already bird catching?
So
there's more to this story, I feel.
Well, they weren't bird watchers. They were just out, you know, sourcing things in the forest themselves. But the photo has them holding the bird by the legs in a way that, I don't know. I mean, I certainly couldn't catch a songbird and hold it to take photographs. So well done to them.
I can't catch
also
a
cold. Catching a rare bird, like you could kill it, the last one. It's like, what did you do? Oh, we shot it, you know.
Well, presumably it's not the last one. I mean, now, presumably it's not the last one, because if there's one, it must have come from somewhere. Its parent wasn't 180 years old, one would imagine.
This is true, yeah. And the jungles of Borneo are one of the most dense forests in the world. So I've no doubt that they're in there somewhere. It's just whoever now wants to go find them as well.
With nets.
Sounds like a fun thing to do. Dr. Shane Bergen from UCD and Dr. Susan Keller from DCU, thanks very much. Welcome back to Future Proof on News Talk. I'm Jonathan McRae. If you'd like to get in touch with us, you can email us, science@newstalk.com. You can also text us for 3010-53106. We get to all of those in the podcast, weirdly enough, but it somehow works. You can find it wherever you find your quality podcasts. Just search for Future Proof. Now, being one of the last people on Earth is a common trope in fiction, one we've all probably pondered at some point. But putting aside the Outer Limits or Twilight Zone fantasies, what if it actually happened? How many people would it take to repopulate the Earth in a healthy way? And could we even do it at all? Professor Philip A. Stevens from the Department of Biosciences at Durham University joins me now. Philip, welcome to the program. So let's talk about animals before we talk about humans. This presumably has been tested in recent times because we are extincting, isn't a verb, but we're extincting species at a terrifying rate. Presumably, we have been able to witness what the lowest number is for some of these species to bring back from the brink.
That's right. I mean, there are a number of different ways you can look at the question of the number from which a population can recover. One of the most common ways to look at that actually is the other side of the coin. It's looking at invasive species. So where an animal has been introduced to a new area and then taken off and formed a population there. And we see a lot of examples of that, particularly on islands where species that didn't formally occur there have been released in small numbers. And of course, you can get large numbers of replica estimates of where that happens and see, on average, what sorts of numbers animals can recover from.
I hadn't thought about that. Yeah, you're right. That's a much better way of examining this, perhaps, because, you know, if you're talking about the last remaining native animals, they're sometimes hard to quantify in that way. Presumably, a large part of the equation is the ecological niche in which the animals or humans find themselves, in availability of resources, ability to thrive, lack of predators, and so on.
Definitely, yes, and also the space, the specific identities of the individuals and how they relate to each other, and the ecological, environmental, and evolutionary background to the species that, or the individuals that are introduced. So, yes, lots of different issues that can bear on the likelihood of success.
If we were to give these two fictional survivors the best possible chance of repopulating the Earth, would we want them to be as geographically distant as possible? For example, someone from Denmark and someone from Aboriginal Australia. Would that be the best thing, to have them as genetically different as possible?
Yeah, something I think that would be very difficult to say, because as well as the problems of breeding with very close relatives, there are problems of breeding with very, very distantly related, or not even related, but
genetically different
individuals. So there are documented problems for a number of species of something called outbreeding, which is where you breed with individuals who are very, very distant genetically. And that can disrupt a lot of co-adapted genes that have evolved to work well together over time. So it's not completely obvious. There's probably a happy medium between those two extremes.
Actually, on that, I suppose if we wanted the most distinct genomes, you'd probably be looking at someone from Africa, because that's where the most genetic diversity can be found, and someone from presumably outside of Africa.
Yeah, I wouldn't like to speculate, to be honest.
This is going well, this interview, isn't it? So these two individuals, say they do manage to have offspring. Those offspring then don't have a lot of options on their plate if they want to continue their race. How does it work? Can we model what dangers there are from having such a tight gene pool, starting with two individuals of one species?
We certainly can model that. I mean, there are two fundamental problems that I suppose are worth identifying. The first of those, I think, rests on our understanding that the majority of our genome is housed on chromosomes, obviously, and we have, as humans, we have two copies of those, two copies of each chromosome, one from our mother and one from our father. And so every gene on those chromosomes, we also have two copies of, and they needn't be identical. They can occur as different variants of genes, and those are what are known as alleles. And some alleles that we carry, some might be mutated in a way that's harmful to us. And if that's the case, if having even one copy of those alleles is dangerous to us, then those alleles won't remain in the population for long. Obviously, if they lead to short life expectancy or a lack of success in breeding, then they're going to be removed very rapidly from the population.
But in humans, cystic fibrosis, Huntington's, these are two sort of genes that if you have two copies, it's generally, it has a very negative predicted health outcome.
That's right. So that's what I was going to say next. Obviously, if they occur in one copy, they're problematic, then they won't persist. But these sorts of genes that you're talking about, or the harmful alleles, are what are known as recessive alleles. So if there's only one copy, they might cause relatively slight problems or no problems at all. But if there are two copies, one inherited from your father and one inherited from your mother, then they cause those full problems and likely lead to very low life expectancy or very low chances of reproduction. And so the chances of getting two of those identical alleles are considerably raised when your parents are strongly related. So that's the main problem, I think, is the exposure of these deleterious or harmful alleles.
So is that it then, or are there other factors to consider having a really tightly knit family group, you know, trying to reach a healthy population of thousands or hundreds of thousands? Is genes and the likelihood of passing down these defective alleles, is that is that the only thing we need to worry about, or are there other conditions that affect the possibilities of a growing ecology?
So I think there are quite a number of other factors. So one of them is behavioral, and as a species, we're conditioned not to be attracted to closely related individuals. Now, exactly what the mechanisms of that are, there may be some aspects of sense of smell, for example, involved, but also there's a strong role for having been brought up together. People are less attracted to those they're brought up with. And so if these first two individuals come from the same household, for example, there's a fair chance that they simply won't want to mate. So that's the first problem. Another problem is that of their immunity. So if they are closely related, they're likely to have very similar immune systems. And because parasites are small, they reproduce very rapidly, they mutate very rapidly and evolve very rapidly. So they can quickly out-evolve our immune defenses, even within our own lifetimes. And if we produce offspring who share those immune defenses, then parasites and diseases can easily overcome the immune defenses of the offspring. So that's really the motivation for sexual reproduction in the first place, is that we want to shuffle up our genome, and in particular, the aspects of our genome that are to do with immunity, in order to produce offspring who have quite different immune defenses to ourselves, and ideally quite different immune defenses to the rest of the population around them. Mm. And then there's one third problem, which I think is worth bearing in mind, which is that if we start with this very small number of individuals, then the overall variability in our genomes in the future is going to be very low, naturally constrained. And I think this is quite a topical thought, because we see now, you know, very, very topical to think about COVID and bring COVID into this. But we can see that people living in very similar situations, people of similar ages, with similar lifestyles and similar backgrounds, react in very different ways to having these diseases. You know, it's quite a selective thing, the mortality that's occurring. And that suggests that there's a strong component of genetic variability in people's predisposition to being strongly affected by that disease. And of course, we can't predict what diseases will emerge in the future. So we want to maximize the available genetic variation to ensure that whatever does come along in the future, as a population, will be able to deal with that, because there will be some individuals who carry genotypes, or who express genotypes, that will allow them to avoid those future threats. And of course, if we start with a very small pool of founders, then the chances are we'll have a very restricted ability to deal with those future threats.
Yeah, a disease that affects very significantly the health of one individual is very likely to have the same effect on everybody else, because there's no variability in the genes. And you could essentially have the equivalent of the potato blight in this population and wipe it all out.
Exactly so. And I mean, the crop analogy is a good one, because, you know, we see this as a constant threat. You know, for example, the world's crop of bananas, the world's crop of rice, all these different crops are derived from very, very few strains. So they have very near identical genetics. And should a new disease arise to damage those, then that could wipe out the whole global crop of one type or another. So yes, it's a good analogy.
Going back to the attractiveness question, in animal species, is that a factor? Do animals care that their offspring are the closest chances of reproducing with them?
I think it depends on the species. So the background to the species and its evolutionary history determine how much of a factor, how much incentive, I suppose, there has been towards incest in the past. So if, for example, you have a species where their ranges are very constrained, they occur at very low densities, perhaps they live in areas where the population can't become very abundant, so on islands or in cave systems, in small pools, then you will get species who are very, or populations who are composed of very close relatives. And in those situations, then a degree of incest has always been necessary for survival. I think we see it as well in species that live within groups, so social groups, and where dispersal among those groups is very risky. So you're very likely to encounter a predator if you venture into unfamiliar territory.
Right.
Then those animals in those species really need to weigh up the benefits and costs. You know, what are the risks of having offspring who are inviable, offspring who carry disease or deformity? What are those risks relative to the almost certainty of dying if I venture outside my known area? And in those cases, those animals as well will likely be much more tolerant of a degree of incest.
If there are just two individuals left, would that lead to a very similar looking culture? Would we all look pretty much identical on this planet? And at what stage would we start to look different and diverse like we do now?
So I think the answer to that depends on who those two individuals are, but certainly there would rapidly, I think, be quite a high degree of similarity between the individuals in the population. Obviously, that would depend on how much variation, what the ancestry of the two founders were. And I think it would take many, many generations if indeed the population could persist that long. It would be many, many generations before we started to see that variability. That said, I think it's worth bearing in mind that humans themselves, as a species, we've been through significant bottlenecks in the past. It's thought that within the last 70,000 years or so, we've been through a bottleneck when the entire human species numbered maybe as few as 1,000 individuals.
Wow.
And so all the variability that we see today could actually have emerged over those admittedly 70 millennia. But that's probably the kind of, you know, we're talking about millennia of evolution before we would start to see that anything approaching today's variability.
If we started with two individuals, how long would it take for us to get to 7 billion, Philip, if everything went well?
So that's quite a tricky question to answer on the fly. My guess is we're talking in the order of about 50 generations, that if we were to say a generation, a human generation, is in the order of 20 years as a very rough back of envelope calculation, then I think we'd be talking about something in the order of 1,000 years. That's imagining a population that doubles every generation. I suppose it's possible we could reproduce more rapidly than that.
Yeah, I read some statistic that that said, you know, the if every woman had a, you know, six or seven children, within a very short number of generations, we'd have repopulated back to 7 billion. That exponential growth, really, once you kick into seven or eight generations, it's enormous. So what you're saying is it could be done, Philip.
It could be done, and it could be done rapidly. Of course, all of these processes are entirely probabilistic. And I would say that starting from two people, the probability of success and long-term viability is very, very low indeed. That probability of success will rise quite rapidly. And many people think that by the time you get to something in the order of 1,000, 5,000 individuals, then that probability of success is well into the high 90s.
Well, Philip Stevens from Durham University, great chatting with you. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
I think we managed to navigate that conversation quite well without blaspheming too much or getting into the nitty-gritty of incest. Producer Aidan McKelvey joins us to go through Texan Street. That was delicately navigated, I thought, for some potential, sticky areas in a conversation about how two people could turn into 7 billion, Aidan.
Yeah. Every week we want to make sure we don't talk about incest or blaspheme. And once again this week,
yes,
we have achieved that goal.
Once again. That's pretty much at the top of the running order every week is just don't say this, don't say that.
Libel, actually, whoever you want, just don't do those two things.
Don't blaspheme. Well, do you know what? The blaspheming doesn't... the only thing the blaspheming does is it welcomes in those emails and letters that we do get still. And we probably will over that as well. I don't know about you. I do doubt... I think the details of that Adam and Eve thing... Like, I think when you really dig in deep, it just seems quite unlikely.
Or when you dig into the shallowest layer of the story, it also seems quite unlikely.
No, but it's a good story, though. It's a good story. Right, time to look at your texts and tweets. This week has just been crazy. So I haven't really looked at them. So I'm quite interested to see what people have said about last week's programme. I bet you there were loads of emails, were there?
There were a good few, yeah.
Oh, were there? Some of which, sarcastic.
Yes, some of which might be quite difficult to understand, having only read them now for the first time. This should be fun.
So, texts and tweets, we were talking about Mars, the Perseverance rover, which is such an impressive thing. Have you been watching the images come in, Aidan? Like, I saw the video with sound, and it was like, just, even though I've seen images of Mars, blah, 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 watching that video did make me feel, holy crap, we're on another planet.
Yeah, it was amazing. I kind of misinterpreted what was going on, so I watched it happen live, and I basically got all my WhatsApp groups excited about, like, yeah, it's going to be live, because I'd read the thing about there being an actual HD video, but I didn't realize the HD video would have to be like edited and not put out live and put out later. So I had a lot of disappointed people who a few days later then got posted the actual video that went out. But the video was amazing.
Yeah. Someone texted in saying, please explain to me why travel to Mars is important. Is it another planet to plunder? Is it as a bolt hole for our species if we ruin this one to the point of uselessness? Does it really matter in the great scheme of things if humans go extinct? Our own planet might recover. Really, is there a point? Plenty of starving people here to feed and sick people to heal. We've had this conversation umpteen times. One of the things that I think of when I reach my dotage of middle age, Aidan, is that if I don't contribute anything to the world, if I leave not a mark in consciousness, history, the history books, what use was I as a person? Like, just creating two other humans, that's not enough. That's basically a skip of my parents to me. My parents, to, you know, having done something, and then me doing nothing, and then my kids maybe might do something. There's a skip there, and so I do ponder those times I get to myself, which mostly in the bathroom. I ponder what is the point of all of this, if not to extend what we know, explore, do new things. That's it. I'm over. That's it. I'm done now. I've done. You can talk.
Yeah, I mean, for once in my entire life, I could not agree with you more. For the only time in my entire life, although I did feel a little like maybe the subtext there of what you were saying had something to do with the fact that you didn't get yourself a Wikipedia article before that.
Look, I'm over the Wikipedia article. I'm over it. Although it's still amazing that, let me just check here, you know, how many weeks since I mentioned it, I thought, you know, let me just
somebody
see.
Will
Wikipedia,
do it.
Jonathan McRae.
No, I totally agree with you. Like, I think that I don't understand people who don't think it's important to kind of try and find out what's out there.
Sorry to interrupt you. I mean, what you're saying is important, but I don't have a Wikipedia page. It just, it's not there. I've got it. I mean, I mentioned on the Lie page, which is a TV show. I mentioned on Evie Nihulavon's page.
It's ludicrous that you notice so well.
Well, you know, I'm just reading it from the thing. So there we are.
How often
I am essentially just. Well, no, I'm you know, see, you brought up the Wikipedia thing. It wasn't even. It's not something I've thought about this afternoon. you know, I haven't thought about it in ages. But I'm known as the presenter of a failed quiz show, although. The premises were quite good. I blame the contestants. And then
failure is a relative term as well.
No, actually, the first season did really well. The second season, not so good. And then I'm known because of my proximity to the wonderful Evie, which actually I'm okay with, because I think, you know, she both is an, I mean, she's a very high achieving woman and also has a level of fame that I don't. So I think it's okay, but it says here, you know, in blue, you can ask for it to be created. The page for Jonathan McRae doesn't exist. I mean, that's almost like saying I don't exist. Do you know what I mean, Aidan? It's like saying I don't exist. You can ask for it to be created, but then it says, but consider checking the search results to put, you know, so and I mean, we've done this already. We don't need to do it again, do we?
Are you going to do this live?
It says, look, it basically says, look, buddy, don't make your own Wikipedia page. Just don't do it.
Yeah, as one of our listeners said as well.
It says, don't do it. So I'm not going to. Anyway, you brought it up. I didn't bring it up. I don't care.
Yeah, that's fair enough.
So anyway, why are we on Mars? I think it's the instigator for that. Why do we want to go to Mars? Well, dude, what else is there to do right now? Like, okay, healing the sick, fine. But there'll always be sick people to heal. There'll always be starving people to feed. You know, is that
that's what, a false dichotomy as well? If it, but you can't do both.
You can't do both. But then, like, if we just heal the poor, heal the sick, and feed the poor all the time, and that's all we do, then we're just a Gordian knot. You know, like all we're doing is just feeding ourselves and existing to keep us going. And art, culture, exploration, science, these are the things that go beyond a single lifetime. All right, that's that text. I hope all the texts don't require such coverage, because otherwise we'll be here for a while. On switching magnetic poles, yeah, we heard that the Earth flips the magnetic poles occasionally, and a new theory suggests that the Neanderthals met their untimely end in a quick flip of a switch, which I wasn't fully convinced by. But Liam Og Griffin says, I heard that everyone who was wearing a magnetic bracelet that day did a cartwheel in unison. Be very interesting to watch, wouldn't it? We talked about vaccine trials. So it's unethical to give 18 to 30 year olds a virus. Oh, this is, we were talking about, you know, why it's kind of tricky when you've got a virus and you infect people knowing that there could be major consequences. You have to be really sure of the benefit. And I use the analogy of war, that, you know, people decide to go to war because there's a huge risk and a smaller risk to avert that crisis is considered to be the right thing. Like, I'm very much anti-war, but if I wasn't, that's what I'd say. And This guy says, so I said, don't be giving the virus to 18 to 30 year olds unless we're really sure we're going to get good data that will destroy the virus, because these people could be harmed for no reason. And the text says, so it's unethical to give 18 to 30 year olds a virus that has 0.003% chance of harming them, and yet you have no issue with giving an experiment therapy injection with unknown long-term side effects to 7.5 billion people. Well, I mean, I know what you're saying about, you know, vaccinating people, but vaccines have gone through the safety checks, and we must trust in the people who have undertaken these checks, because if we don't trust in anybody, then you can't walk out the street. Plus, how can they give a droplet of the virus to anyone when they admit that they never isolated it? You people are dangerous. I like that. You people are extremely dangerous. I'm imagining that person is waving their finger at us in a wide arc.
Yeah, or while shaking their fist in a cloud.
Clutching catcher in their eye in their other hand or something. On unevolving crocodile, someone says, was there a flying crocodile? We're talking about the crocodiles just being pretty awesome and just never changing over hundreds of millions of years. And someone says, was there ever a flying crocodile? I was going to say, good question. But is it a good question?
I'm assuming they're going back to the sort of early relationship with dinosaurs, but I think it's a totally different branch.
Yeah,
I don't think there was ever a crocodile or anything
expert,
like that.
But let me weigh in here and say no. Tiffany says, love imagining herbivorous burrowing crocodiles. I mean, if you can have herbivorous burrowing crocodiles, you can have flying crocodiles, I guess. And we were talking about beginnings, speaking to Tom Vanderbilt, who's speaking at SCICOM, SCICOM.ie. Get your tickets now. Dr. Jessica Collis said, really fascinating how adults versus children learn a physical skill. Must check out the science. And Colin Horgan says, we had great fun in the army learning to march in step, which, if done right, is just walking. A few people overthought it and ended up doing the right arm forward with the right leg forward. Try doing that and it feels bizarre. Took a few hilarious weeks to fix. Yeah. Well, I used to do the panto. Did you know this, Aidan?
I did. This
I've done it all.
I'm intrigued.
Man. I've done it all. I was the villain in the panto, in the Cheerios panto.
Excellent.
And I had the tights and the wig, and I did dancing, and I couldn't do any of the dancing. I just couldn't get my body to do what everyone else's body was doing at the same time. So they said, you know what, you just mix it up, you just do what you want on stage. And so I just did a bit of a dance solo where I sort of gyrated all over the place, because I was a sexual deviant in many ways. I played Gaston, and he, you know, he's a bit of a, I mean, he's a predator. So I had to be very careful, really, because you've got a bunch of kids and you're thrusting your groin there, because you're supposed to be like, because I, you know, it's Beauty and the Beast. I'm they want to hate me, and so I have to be like inappropriate. When I think back on it, there's a lot of messages there. I got a lot to deconstruct.
When I think back on it, I think that director was very brave indeed. The casting director.
The casting director was Alan Hughes and his boyfriend at the time. I think they became husband later on, but I think they weren't married at that stage. They weren't. And they were the best crack ever. I basically just drank and then went on stage the next day and had the crack and then drank for a month. Now, obviously not recommended to people who are trying to avoid serious addictions. And I was getting steroids quite regularly towards the end. But look, it was a long time ago.
This is such a debaucherous tale.
Oh, it was just great. It was great. Yeah. There's lots we could talk about, but I can't talk about it. So let's just leave that there before I get everybody in trouble and say thanks for listening. We'll be back with more Future Proof in your podcast feed on Tuesday. Thanks to the production team, Aidan McKelvey, Simon Keane, Steve Daunt, Garrett Mulhall, and Steve McClune, who was on sound. We'll be back with, as I say, more on Tuesday, live on News Talk at 12 p.m. on Saturday. In the meantime, stay curious.